You touched on the Rhinelander School of the Arts a few moments ago. I would like to know a little bit more how that was inaugurated.
The Rhinelander School of Arts was started in 1964. It had been thought about before then for some time. The thing that really stimulated it, I thought for a long time that Northern Wisconsin ought to have a summer art school where people particularly envisaged this being used chiefly by Northern Wisconsin people. It never worked that way. Northern Wisconsin people were relatively uninterested until late years, so they began to take an interest in it. But you can understand that when so many people up there are engaged in the tourist business and look upon the summer months as money-making months for the whole year and don't have time really to do very much in taking a week out of their life or 2 weeks and going to a school of arts. That's chiefly the reason for it. It's not really lack of interest, I don't think. But anyway, we did inaugurate this partly because L.G. Sorden had been county agent there very early in the 1920s, late 20s. He became county agent of Oneida County. And being the kind of man he was, very friendly and affable, he made many friends and put down deep roots of affection for Rhinelander. And so one day we were talking, I said, LG, if you were going to start a school of arts someplace in the state, where do you think we ought to do this? He said, without any question, the community of Rhinelander. Well, in many ways, since I have regretted that choice. It is a fine, small city.
If you had it to do over, where would you?
I don't know, but the reason that it hasn't worked 100% there is that community is extremely summer tourist oriented and doesn't want to do anything which might take a penny of money away from people who are running resorts and motels and this kind of thing. And what we really needed up there was a housing facility of low cost so that we could offer a low tuition, including a residence cost, and make it possible for ordinary people to go to a thing like that. We never have had that, don't have it to this day. We have to house people in places like the Claridge Motel, very expensive, like the Holiday Acres Resort, very expensive, like a dozen other smaller motels, now very expensive. Private homes are beginning to have to take students now. There just is no central place for them to live. We've always missed it.
Have you financed their living quarters while they were there, or did they have to?
No, they have to pay it, you see, and that's part of the problem.
Uh-huh.
And, our tuition, I've tried to keep low. We started at $35, now it's $90. They've forced us in the university to keep raising these tuition fees.
Oh, how could they do that?
Well, regents say you must raise your fees to meet your costs. So we have to do it. We have no choice. It's an order from on high. But you'd be surprised what a $10 raise tuition, it makes a difference. So we've had to struggle every year for enrollment. When we started, I think I had about 40 people enrolling in that. Now we had last summer over 325.
Well, so it is going along.
But we've reached the end. We can't house any more people up there. You pile that many people in on a community already bulging in the summer, you can't find good housing for them. So, but the school is magnificent. The Rhinelander School Board has always provided us with beautiful quarters at no cost. And we have had their newest buildings, their best art rooms and music rooms and facilities. And this has made it possible for us to do that. And I suppose when you weigh that kind of thing against the other drawbacks, maybe it outweighs them. So I can move that to any one of our 27 branch university campuses and make a lot more money because they've got open dormitories there. And I could house these people for modest amounts of money, but we can't. We can't really move out of Rhinelander now. Our roots are too deep there. So I've fought that battle over the years. I had many ways, many schemes of how this should go, and some of them have worked and some of them haven't. But I've kept an excellent teaching staff there all the time. So that a farm woman wanting really excellent, the best in the country instruction and how to write poetry, can go there for a week and get it. See, that rent for $90, that's not much, really, if you stop to think about it, what they get out of it. They can go to school all day long if they want to, take any number of courses, if they can find the strength to do it.
And it rents for just a week in the summer.
It does now. I had it ran 3 weeks, and that was too long. People couldn't stay that long. And there was a changeover. The instructors didn't like that because they had to go back and repeat every week and so forth. So we finally made it 1 week, and it's worked better that way. We concentrated, and it's a tough week. It really is a tough week. But the school has made a national reputation. We get students from all over the country.
Oh, that's very good.
And they come there, and then they have just a ball. They like it very much. And we have such a warm and pleasant time there that I guess I can't see much chance that project will fail. It could if the university or university extension gets much poorer than it is.
And put more strictures on.
They have in the past. Right now, they've put many strictures on us and are now charging us for overhead and staff time that I, for example, when I was on the staff here, last year they charged a portion of my salary off against the Rhinelander School of Arts, which they'd never done before.
Huh.
So this kind of thing has made it increasingly difficult for us. But it's last year we made our budget, and it looks like we might make it this year. And it's pretty high. It costs us close to $30,000 to stage that out of pocket.
That is a lot of money.
It is for a week, and we pay our instructors very well. We get the best ones we can get. It costs money, a lot of money.
Yes.
So I don't know what's going to happen, but that's briefly the story of that. I've chiefly been the spearhead of that. And I've always been the artistic director of it. And then the Northern Arts Council, a local group, got organized in behalf of the school to help it, and they've helped it immensely. They've contributed a couple of $3,000 a year to it, and it's been just a fine arrangement, and everything has worked very well.
Well, that's good news. You mentioned Sarden a minute ago in connection with Rhinelander, and I know he was county agent up there for a time. How did you get to know him?
The way I first got to know him was when I first came here. He had been put in charge of a cooperative extension of trucks and rolling vehicles And we went to them and asked, I forget, I think Warren Clark was the director there. We asked Warren if he'd lend us a truck. We wanted to tour some plays. They had a big panel truck. Warren said, why, sure, as long as we're not using it, you might as well use it. So I had a very good fellow working part-time for us, a reliable guy, but he made one serious error. He didn't get the oil changed soon enough in that big truck when he had it out, and it did some damage to the engine. I can remember L.G. Swordnose, first time I met him, coming over to my office, angry as he could be, and bawling me out for not getting the oil changed in his truck. And I tried to explain the situation, which he accepted gracefully. But from that time on, we were extremely good friends. And, I knew that he had a great deal of interest in local subjects, and he was a kind of a folk character himself, as you know. He could talk to a group of farmers in their language, and they understood what he was talking about, and they liked his big, fat belly, and his big laugh, and this kind of thing. So I made great use of him. I even had him in a play or two, if you can believe
it. In a play?
I did.
How'd you do?
I played one time. I gave him the role of a raftsman who was in love with a fair young maiden on the Little Eau Claire River. There's a ballad about that, and Helen O'Brien played the part of the young maiden. It was the funniest thing I ever saw, you know. But people just loved it. Then he and I took young Dave Peterson under our wing, and Dave, talented musician, composer, and he wrote a number of musicals, and LG and I established kind of a partnership in touring these things, first under the College of Agriculture. And then as time went on, I went more and more toward literature and writing. And eventually, seeing that regional publishing was the coming thing in the United States, I started a publishing house called Wisconsin House. And I asked LG if he'd had any interest in coming in as my partner on this. And he said, sure, absolutely. And we each contributed $1,200 and established Wisconsin House for the purpose of publishing Wisconsin written books.
And did they have to be about Wisconsin?
Yeah, they did. And we got it legally incorporated and everything, and it was a business. I don't know whether we were legitimate in doing it. It may have been a conflict of interest. I'm not sure. Nobody told us it was. But it might have been a conflict of interest because I was working with state writers all the time. But we never thought about that kind of thing. The first book we published was my book called This Is Wisconsin, which is still one of the best-selling books in the state. It was published in 1968.
I've seen it in the bookstore.
It's gone through about 10 big printings since. And if we had had the business sense, which neither one of us really did have, we were just kind of bumbling businessmen, and had published only a few things which could make money, or like Wild Goose Marsh, which made a great deal of money, instead of trying to be helping publishers to every jacktail coming writer in the state. We published a lot of poetry, and this thing has lost us lots of money. We would have made, say, financial success out of it.
Suggesting you didn't. You lost money.
Well, we lost money at one time. We were in debt to the Strauss Printing Company who did our printing. We were in debt, I'd hate to tell you how many $1,000s to them, but we began to pull out of it, and eventually they bought Wisconsin House, and out from that point on, we were completely out of the financial responsibility, which pleased me very much because I could see myself drifting toward a bankruptcy problem eventually, but we never had to face it.
So that's the financial reasons is really why you sold
out? It really is. It's the sole reason, financial. And it didn't need to happen. Didn't need to happen because on two or three of our early books, we were paying our bills and making a little bit of money, not much, but a little bit.
Is the new management still leaning toward Wisconsin Publications?
Mm-hmm, completely. The steps that have happened after Wisconsin House, it was sold to the Strauss Printing Company. Strauss sold it to the August Derleth interests at Sauk City, called Stanton and Lee Publishing Company. Stanton and Lee and still have it, and eventually got the backing and sold. That group sold out to the Carley Brothers' interests, and Carley is operated now as a book publishing company.
Because they have their fingers in more pies.
They sure do, and I don't know how they're doing. I haven't the faintest idea, but I think they're doing modestly well. They can stay with it long enough, they might make it. It's hard, though. Book publishing is very, very difficult today because of the expenses that are involved in it. Paper costs,
editorial costs,
oh gosh.
Binders costs.
Everything costs so much money that you have to charge so much for your books, you can't sell too many of them. That's really one of the crux of it.
Even the cost of paperbacks has risen dramatically.
Well, I noticed that Mark's charging $14 for that Garden Guide to Wisconsin, which is just a paperback book. You know, that's pretty high for a paperback. But that's in line with others that are getting. So it's a thickish book and probably worth money if you want that kind of thing. But the average guy isn't going to pay $14 for a book like that.
Not likely.
Not likely to. That's happened to me, and it's the reason that I don't make very much royalty on my books. My sales are modest, and the prices of my books are high. What more can I tell you?
Well, let's see. I don't think you've talked very much about some of your work on a national level, or I was thinking specifically of Rockefeller Foundation grant that I think you had for mm-hmm. a nationwide study of community theaters.
Yeah, yeah.
And you made a tour, I understand.
I did two of those things. I made a tour in 1957-58. Well, I did three. I made a tour in 1953 under Rockefeller sponsorship of the British Isles, and made a report on the state of the arts in the British Isles. I made a national survey in 1957-58 of the American Community Theater under Rockefeller sponsorship. I, in 1967, for the National Theater Conference, I did this book called Theater in America, which was a survey of the American theater as it was then. It's changed a lot since 1967, but it was a significant book. And
how has it changed? Tell me a little bit.
Oh, my goodness. The patterns of playwriting have changed. The language of the theater has changed a great deal. Economic situation has changed. The ticket pricing has gone up sky high. The touring business is not at all what it was. And New York theater is not at all the kind of theater that it used to be. It's the unions have become so powerful, the equity, actors' equity, and the musicians and the electricians and scene designers union practically dominate the theater today. And it's impossible to stage anything with even large amounts of money. You can't do very much, and you have no chance at all of ensuring that. Your chances of losing your money are greater than they've ever been. It's that kind of change. It's hooked to our whole economic change in the country, and the fact that people don't respond in the same way they used to theater. The community theater movement is still going well. I don't know that I have a copy of the book here. I could get you one. I think I have one at home. Theater in America.
What did you find out about in your travels in Europe? What was the situation
there compared to here? That was what we were trying to do there, was get a line on what had been done in Britain as one example that might be repeated here. They'd established the British Arts Council a long time during the World War II. They established that. And in a sense, that stimulated our own Arts Council movement. America. I wanted to look at the places that this was flourishing and how they operated this. And so I did. I traveled widely over the British Isles. And very intimately, I had the sponsorship of the British Council. And they furnished all kinds of help to me there.
Did you get some useful information as a result of this?
I got a great deal of useful information, which I put in a major report to the Rockefeller Foundation. How much they used it, I don't know.
Well, then, and how did you get interested in Finland?
Finland, I got interested in because I was out of the blue offered a theater research, a Fulbright research fellowship there for a year. I didn't know anything about Finland, but I think of all the things that I've done, that's been the most gratifying, because I found the Finnish people so beautifully receptive, and with such a long background of appreciation of the arts, and their craftsmanship is so great in design and in the theater arts especially. I did there the first study of the role of the Finnish playwright that had ever been done in Finland. And it was published by their scholarly press. And I think it did a great deal of good. I took my whole family with me. We spent a delightful year. I've always been since a great Finophile, terribly interested. As you can see by that thing there, I'm one of half a dozen Americans who belong to the Finnish Academy. I don't know why they made me a member, but I am a member of the Finnish Academy. The Summa Laitonteidi got them up.
Well, I read they gave you a Medal of Honor, too.
I have a Medal of Honor from the Finnish National Theater.
Well, didn't you establish
Jubilee Medal of the Government of Finland?
didn't you at least help establish a program of theater education at the University of Helsinki?
Yes, and I went back three times to teach in Finland, or four times. And they established a Department of Theater Arts, chiefly because of my influence there.
How is this doing?
I think it's doing well. I don't know. I haven't kept very close track of it. Late year. But I was able, while I was there, to stimulate an exchange of professors between this university and the University of Helsinki, which is the largest and oldest in Northern Europe. And that is still going on. I'm very proud, very proud of that. Every year, one goes each way. And they're being vied for now quite avidly. And it's a rare, real wonderful thing. We've had trouble financing it from time to time, but the graduate school here has been extremely helpful. And this was affected largely under the presidency of Conrad Elvehjem.
Sounds like a very, very worthwhile.
Yeah, it's been a worthwhile thing to do.
Well, I have read that you sort of feel that this kind of international cultural exchange is probably very useful in a world of turmoil.
Yeah, I think I believe that very greatly, and my hope is that the small foundation that we have established at Aldebaran and near Spring Green will eventually turn into a small international center for exchange of ideas relating to rural areas and small communities, not only in this country, but in other nations where this is a problem. And I guess it's a problem in almost every nation, as far as I know.
Yes, quite possibly. I'll come back to that. I'd like to know some details from you about it. But first, earlier on, I want to know something about your interest in Portage and the Theatre Historique.
I've always known, as everybody else does in the state, that the location of Portage is one of the very important places in the whole United States, and of course the reason for that is the pattern of travel. Ancient Indians, explorers, fur traders, voyageurs, military, settlers, all came down using the Fox River waterway to Portage, across to the Wisconsin, and down the Wisconsin to the Mississippi and north or south, whichever, to the Gulf of Mexico or the Falls of St. Anthony. It's one of the great highways of the world. So I thought that what a great idea it would be to someday have a history theater running at Portage, which could portray some of the great dramatic events which have taken place there. It was a major trading point and meeting place, and it's unique because the land falls off one way, and on the other side, within a mile, falls the other way. So the Fox River runs north, and the Wisconsin runs south and west there. The portage is not a long one, and I thought somewhere in there should be place for an outdoor theater. What we had in mind at Tampere, Finland, and I spent some time there, is one of the two or three in the whole world, a revolving amphitheater. That is, it's a thing where the seats are built on a large revolving platform, and the entire audience is turned to different stages around the circumference of the playing surface.
Oh, I've heard of revolving stages.
No, this is not like that. And the one in Tampere plays full all the time. And I thought, I know how they built that. The Finns built it out of wood, and they built it at minimal expense. They did it at that time for a total of $30,000. And we went in, a local committee was formed. They were highly interested and motivated by this. They raised a lot of money locally. They got a loan from a small business association. And I heard the other day from one of the people, I didn't know this, who had been in that, that one time they had $500,000 in the bank to start building this. However, there was a sort of a peculiar fellow drifted in from the east, very attractive guy, talked glibly. Was connected with a firm who could supply this great turntable that was needed there. And he sold them on the idea of making him the manager.
What was his name?
Robert Gilbert, G-U-I-L-B-E-R-T. And thinking, I don't know what became of him. I believe he may be living in Milwaukee still. But he had vast ideas, much too big for that little community up there, that's very conservative. And they could see this up to a point. They purchased the land. They got the most historic piece of land that exists there, right next to old Fort Winnebago. Gilbert began to seek outside capital for this. And at one point had one of the great motel chains in the country who were hearsay ready to put up a large hotel up there and to finance the Sampa Theater. Mm. And according to Gilbert and other people were associated with him in that, including Gerald Bartell here in Madison. This came so close that the day before they were to sign the contracts, letting the contracts to build that installation up there, that chain was sued by the federal government on antitrust charges. They had been doing something, and I don't know what, which was alien to the antitrust laws of the United States. And so they were prohibited by law from engaging in any new enterprises for a long period of time. And this killed it, because by that time they were so sure they were going to get this money that they had returned all the local funds that were accumulated. People bought stock in this.
Oh.
And they gave it all back, and then there was nothing. Meanwhile, the colonial dames, who didn't like the idea of this from the very first and had the old Indian Agency House, built a structure near where the theater was going to be, and brought all kinds of pressure on the city of Portage and everything not to let anything be built anywhere near the old Indian Agency House. Well, of course, that's where it had to be. It was the historic ground. And so those are the kinds of things that killed it off. It was a bitter disappointment to me. Mm-hmm. And we even had part of a play written for it and everything. And, it could be today, could be one of the great institutions, I'm sure, of Middle America, if we could have just gone a little bit further than it. But it didn't work. And why it didn't, I don't know. Who was to blame? Most people blame this Gilbert for scotching it, and I don't know why he did the things he did. I haven't any idea. But he did.
Portage didn't get it.
Portage didn't get it, and now it will never happen. Never.
That won't happen. Are they out to have a theater?
No. No, they've got the old opera house in downtown. That's all they'll ever have.
That's a shame.
Listen, that's one of the great shames of the world. This could have been just magnificent. If there had been somebody with the push and drive of these American players out of Spring Green, I guess it would have happened, because those people just won't stop. They go into debt deeper and deeper and deeper, but they're going to keep going.
How did they get started?
They drifted into that area and liked it and decided they'd build an amphitheater there and start a classical Shakespearean theater. It was as simple as that. They've been in trouble ever since.
But they're going strong anyway.
They're going strong. And this year they've had a magnificent ticket sale. But they've got so far to go. I just don't know. Don't know.
Let's hope that they keep going. I don't think we've mentioned the Man in the Mink Theater.
The
Man in Mime, excuse me. In the production of The Chairs, and I understand you both directed it and played in it.
Oh, we did a lot of those avant-garde plays when that was popular. I started the Man in Mime Theater as a part of drama and religion here, and I was very interested in that for a while. Grace Episcopal Church did a great deal. We had the first conferences on the subject in this whole part of the country down there on the square. And the whole thing looked very promising. The Man in Mime Theater was an acting company, and I made an attempt to get the very best directors I could for it. And we did original plays and we did classics. We did the tragical history of Dr. Faustus in Grace Episcopal Church, and it just about disrupted the whole church. It became a theater. For several weeks there were nothing but cables and everything all over that place. But it was a great show, and it's still remembered to this day.
Why did you do it in the theater, in the church?
Well, we felt that this belonged in a religious setting.
Does the church give you any trouble over this?
Yeah. They were very good about it. Huh. I suppose some grumped a little bit, but it wasn't bad.
Is it still going on?
Or? Unfortunately not. I don't know. I went away for a year and it got into other channels. It could have gone on and on and on, because it was one of those things that had a chance of great permanency. Probably I'm to blame for it that I didn't push it harder. I had so many things that were interesting.
Well, I gather you had a lot of things you were doing. Well, something else I've read about that you had something to do with was a drama workshop for high school students.
When I first came here, we conducted many, many of those things. That was a chief thought of ours, that we had to bring the theater into the schools. And this was done largely under the Wisconsin Forensic Association, which was a statewide association of the teachers of speech. And the resident department here was very interested in this. And almost every Saturday, a crew of us would go out to some central high school or other where people would come in from all over we'd have a day of workshop on theater arts. And I guess that must be what you're referring to.
Mm-hmm.
This went on for a long time, and when I quit it, it was carried on even, I think it may be even going on today, but I've lost track of it. It did a lot of good. It did a lot of good. There are play contests associated with it, competitions, and all that kind of thing.
You feel that high school is a good time to introduce students to theater?
Oh, it is, very good, and even earlier than high school. We've done everything. We have sponsored children's theater companies that have toured the state. And I don't know, you can almost mention it. We've tried it here. I don't think many people even know about all the things. This afternoon, I'm going to the memorial service of the first person that I personally hired here to help me. His name was Ronald G.
G? How do you spell that?
G-E-E. He wrote a PhD thesis on the arts in the agricultural college. He was a fine, fine man, and he left here to go to the University of Iowa, and then he went to Northern Illinois University. And they got asthma so bad he had to move to Arizona. Got a good job, was head of one of the educational departments in the state of Arizona. But he always wanted to visit England. And so just recently he had a chance to go to England with a couple of relatives who were going over there. And my gosh, he got to London and had an asthma attack and died.
Of asthma?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I've heard people can.
He had it very bad. If he had stayed in Arizona, he'd have been okay. But in London, he couldn't take it. And so this afternoon, I'm going to his memorial service. Very sad, because he did good work here. Very fond of him.
Well, I guess so.
Maybe we better have another session, because I've run a little thin and I've got a lecture to get ready for.
I want to begin with just a small question that I'm curious, something I'm curious about, which is why the name of the Wisconsin Idea Theater was changed. I thought that was a terribly nice name, and it became something else.
That is a very interesting question to me, because I opposed that. It happened, as I remember, about 1968, 69, or 70, someplace in there, that a kind of turnover, as you can well imagine, during the first 20 years that I was here. Many of the leaders in this movement had been, by mere virtue of their age, acquainted with and connected with some of the older traditions of the state. And many of them had been on the scene when Robert La Follette Sr. Was still in the United States Senate. And so there was a very dedicated and devoted group of people when I came here to the idea of the Wisconsin Idea, which, as I think I told you, was the reason I chose that as the name of the project that I led here. As time went on, these older people began to drop by the wayside, and younger people came in, especially in the the college crowd situation. It hadn't been too long before that the university system had been merged, and it was a new ball game. I guess that's what you would have to say. There had been also a pattern that was being set in different states in the country to call the theater associations by just a simplification of the state name, like the Carolina Theater Association, Alabama Theater Association, and so forth. And so the board of directors, and I forget what year this was, but it might have been 1970, sought a board action to change the name, thinking that this would conform and make it easier for people to understand what this association was about. It was basically as simple as that. There was no animus against me, nor against the ideas of the Wisconsin Idea, except that they were not as familiar with them as some of the others had been. I thought this was an absolutely great idea. And so I couldn't do very much to oppose that. And so the name of the association itself, which I had called the Wisconsin Idea Theater Conference, was changed to the Wisconsin Theater Association. I was careful not to change other parts of my program. That was the only major part of it that was revised in these terms, and so I went ahead with the Wisconsin Idea attached to our stationery and so forth on many fronts that were not really targeted on the State Association of Community Theaters. Mm-hmm. And this began to include college and high school activities in theater. As a matter of fact, it has grown since those early days until now. The Wisconsin Theater Association is the largest state association of groups banded together in behalf of the what you might call the grassroots theater arts. They're not a professional organization, but they do include the educational theater, they include the community theater, they include the high school theater, some church groups, theater, and this kind of
thing. I see.
That's in essence why that part of the name was changed. I was sorry because the name Wisconsin Idea Theater had grown very well known not only in this country but abroad, and many people came here seeking the offices of the Wisconsin Idea Theater, or the theater itself, which we did not have. It was just an idea. But that's about the size of that.
Another thing that I don't think we talked about was the Institute of Wisconsin Nationalities. I don't believe we've gone.
Well,
into
this
that.
Happened partly because I was the chief director of the great folk festival in Milwaukee called Holiday Folk Fair. I did that for 12 or 15 years, probably. And each year, I would write a different type of script to be staged in the Milwaukee Auditorium to crowds of, it was full for every performance, and I don't know how many audience members we reached with that, but a tremendous number in the 2 days that the festival went on. I was very interested in this approach to the folk arts, and we had many nationality groups represented in the display rooms and the sales rooms there, as well as this great floor show. And it was very, very successful, still is going on, and,
oh,
is, and is highly, I think, highly successful. It's possibly not quite the same thing. But I grew very much interested in this, and also aware of the fact that there were many nationality groups throughout the state of Wisconsin that might well have performing expressions of their tradition and culture. And so it just happened that at that time Warren Knowles was governor of the state. And he and I, for some reasons or other, I guess just kind of instinctive mutual liking for one another, were very close. And he came and relied on me for some bits of advice and guidance and an occasional piece of writing that he had to deliver somewhere. I did quite a bit of that for him. And finally I said to him, Warren, we've got all these nationality groups. We've got to get some way to let the public know about these things that are sort of unique to Wisconsin. And the Holiday Folk Fair was one. So we talked about that a bit, and then I proposed to him that the state establish an institute of nationalities, in which we would have a statewide committee. We'd have at least one annual meeting of this, either in Madison or elsewhere. As governor, he agreed to come and be the main speaker at these events. And then I expanded that idea by trying to envision what we call the Trail of Nations. In other words, we made the location points on a map of where the festivals, folk fairs, this kind of musical or singing fest or whatnot were held or being held around the state. And our idea was that we'd work with the Bureau of Touristry on this, and when people were thinking of coming into the state, somehow the Bureau would have information available on the Wisconsin Trail of Nations, which they could follow if they wished on part of their vacation all around.
To different festivals. Different nationalities.
And see quite a bit of the native lore of the state. It was a good idea. We launched it, and I can't remember the year. It was when he was governor and had been governor for some time.
I think it was around 1966.
I suppose. Like that. That's about where it was. And we launched it at Mineral Point, I remember, and where the Cornish tradition was so big, and I think maybe that had something to do with the subsequent taking over of the Mineral Point Cornish tradition, the houses and whatnot, by the State Historical Society.
Oh.
We went the trail, I can't even begin to tell you where it went. I know it went over toward La Crosse. It went through Richland Center. There's a big Bohemian settlement at Richland Center, or near Richland Center up in the hills. There are all kinds of Norwegian settlements at Mount Horeb and in the La Crosse area, particularly very big Norwegian settlements there. I remember the trail went up the Mississippi River to Somerset, where there is a French collection of immigrants who maintain their tradition, what they call the pea soup festival up there.
The what?
Pea soup.
Pea soup? That's what I thought you'd say.
I did. But you know, the French are supposed to be more fond of pea soup than any other common man's food that they eat. So they have a pea soup festival.
Then they were going to carry on into the Finnish settlements in Douglas County and over toward Hurley, where they have had by that time established the Finnish-American National Festival. And we're very, very keen and energetic in doing that. Then we went down, I remember, toward the Green Bay area and east of there toward the Belgian settlements, where there are all kinds of hangovers, including kermesses and this kind of expression. Then we went down toward Kewaunee again, where there was a lot of Bohemian people. And then, I don't know, we cut south along the lake shore to the Dutch and Luxembourger settlements, I know, because the Dutch were putting on every summer dancing displays of wooden shoe dancing, or klompen dancing, as they called it. Then we went back over toward Stevens Point, where there's large Polish country Polish influence in that part of the state. And then we went south toward Cambria, where there's a big Welsh settlement and the preservation of Welsh singing traditions there. Eisteddfod still goes on there. And we went over from there to toward Wales, Wisconsin, again, where there is a big Welsh settlement. The German people, we planned to view whatever they might develop in Dodge County and Washington and Ozaukee counties. Those were principally heavily settled German settlements in the early days. Went through Watertown, I remember, where there was a goose festival in the early days. They were great on raising geese and selling them to the New York market and whatnot. Mm. That's the kind of thing it was. Mm-hmm. It got started and was, I don't know how many people took advantage of it. I got into other things, and Mr. Knowles, of course, did not remain forever as governor.
True.
And I think that part of it has pretty well dropped out of sight as a trail. It's still a good idea and could be activated at any time and would do a lot for the state. I've always known that. But that's about the kind of thing it was.
I need some publicizing, I guess.
Oh, I think it needed a full-time promoter, all of this.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
I agree, it's a good idea.
Yeah.
I like the sound of it myself. Well, as a small thing, we've already talked about your your activities in Portage about the theater.
Mm-hmm.
But I noticed that you were also a member of the Portage Canal Committee. What
role
did
Governor,
you do on that?
Well, Governor Knowles again appointed me on the committee. It was had the objective to try to decide what to do with that very historic canal, which is still up there. It's a fascinating problem because most of the business buildings that were built along that canal actually were never cleared in their titles, and technically the federal government owned, or perhaps still does, own a these people didn't know this. Nobody knew that this was so, and it didn't cause any trouble because nobody stirred it up.
I see.
And I forget what our final decision on that was. I guess it couldn't have been very very dramatic. I know we submitted a report and pointed out the historical importance of preserving this landmark because it was almost among all places in the United States, a vital link in early transportation of all kinds of people, Fox River, Wisconsin River system, and this tiny portage in between them was the link to the Gulf of Mexico and so forth and so on. And
one forgets that.
You forget it. But the canal is not in good condition. It's overgrown with brush and trees. It ought to be cleaned out and made beautiful again along there. I think the problem that we faced was the expense of doing this. And to try to find out who would accept the ownership of the canal. The federal government had it. They didn't want it anymore. The city of Portage was afraid that if they took it over, they'd get into all kinds of financial stresses over it, and that it might cause adverse criticism of the city government and so forth. And I, as I remember, the committee I was on came forward with nothing like any permanent solution to it.
Did anything come of it at all, this study?
It would have come of it if the theater project had gone through. We had plans to put a stern wheeler boat on that canal and run it back and forth so that children and adults could take a ride on this historic
That would have been an attraction.
And we had other ideas about it too, to recreate some of the early characters and songs of the boys, yours, and all those kind of things were going to be used.
Well, that's another good idea that didn't work out.
I've had so many good ideas that didn't work out. If all my ideas had worked out, the state would be quite different.
I
wish they had.
You suggested last time that your relations with Mr. Stevens of the Rockefeller Foundation were practically a story in themselves.
Yeah.
And I'd be interested if you'd go into that a little.
Well, it could be a very long story. I'll try to keep it fairly brief.
Well, if you tell me the high spots.
Yeah. I told you, I think, that David Stevens had been born in the state. He was born at Berlin, Wisconsin. His mother was a Methodist preacher. His father moved to Fort Atkinson, where David chiefly grew through his boyhood days. And following that, the family moved to Appleton, so that the Stevens children might be educated. David had a brother, and I think they were both Lawrence College students. And they bought a house in Appleton, and there established their families so that their children would have advantage of a close at hand, good educational institution. And I think that Reverend Stevens also probably preached in the Methodist church there. I think he did. Well, David himself was an extremely bright man.
May I